Sunstone presents Mothers of the Prophets, Agnes Taylor and the Church's Cambrian Heritage, and Jeanette Eveline Evans McKay and the Church's Welch Heritage, recorded live at the 1986 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 20th through the 23rd. We take you to the Salt Lake Sheraton and Towers, where the program is just now beginning.
Consisting of two papers on the theme, Mothers of the Prophets. The first paper will be given by Leonard Arrington, one of the most respected scholars in the church, as well as a very popular speaker. I first became acquainted with Leonard through his book, Great Basin Kingdom, which has since become a classic. Leonard is a regular contributor to many scholarly journals. He has co-authored, along with Davis Bitten, The Mormon Experience, which has been widely acclaimed. And more recently, he has authored Brigham Young, American Moses, which has won numerous awards and is certainly destined to become a classic as well. Leonard has taught at North Carolina State, UCLA, and Utah State Universities. Since 1972, he's been the Leonard Red Professor of Western History at BYU. He is also the former director of the History Division of the Church. His daughter, the title of his talk will be Agnes Taylor and the Church's Cambrian Heritage. He will be followed by his daughter, Susan Arrington Manson. And I think this is probably the first time in the history of the Sunstone Conference we've had two members of the same family speaking at a single session. Susan is also a very respected scholar. Someone described her as very much a continuation of Leonard. She was born in Logan at the time that Leonard was teaching at Utah State University. She resides in Logan now, together with her three children and her husband, who's on the music faculty at Utah State. She has been doing serious scholarly writing for about 10 years now. She has co-authored Sunbonnet Sisters, which is a collection of essays on the lives of Mormon women. The title of her talk, or her paper, will be Jeanette Evelyn Evans McKay and the Church's Welch Heritage. Following these two papers, we will reserve some time for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Randall. There were some splendid sessions this same hour, and I commend any of them to you, at least during the period of my talk. It's a in the spring of this year, when the presidents of the church appeared, Susan and I got together and said to each other, you know, we should have one on the mothers of the presidents. They were extremely influential in preparing the persons, their sons, to be prophets of the church. And so we set to work immediately, both of us, more or less full time, feeling very strongly the need to have a story on each of the mothers of the prophets. We have just finished that 13 essay manuscript just this week, and hope to turn it over to a publisher next week. I think there is no doubt that we have learned a great deal about their sons, the prophets, as the result of studying their mothers and the experiences they had, which they conveyed to their sons. Will Comfort said, I believe mothering is the loveliest of the arts, that great mothers are handmaidens of the Spirit, to whom are entrusted God's avatars, that no prophet is greater than his mother. Susan and I thought that these two papers would make a certain, would give a certain unity to this session, because they're both women who came from Great Britain. Agnes Taylor came from Northwest Britain, and Jeanette McKay, that Susan will discuss, came from Wales. Both of them spent at least part of their childhood in Britain. Agnes Taylor did not come to the United States until she was in her 50s. She did not come to Canada until she was 43 years old. So most of her experience was in Great Britain, and one can only understand her and her influence on John in terms of her British experience. Agnes Taylor was born in 1787, the second daughter and fourth child in a family of which, after her, saw the birth of three additional sons and one daughter. Her parents were John Taylor and Agnes Whittington Taylor, and at the time of her birth, they lived in a small village of Pooley, Barton Parish, Westmoreland County, in northwest England. Agnes later married James Taylor, the father of John Taylor, our prophet, but it is coincidental that the last names of her father and husband were the same. There was no blood relationship. Westmoreland County is just across the Irish Sea from the Isle of Man and Northern Ireland, bordered on the north by the Cumbrian Mountains, the highest mountains in England, and on the west by Morecambe Bay, an inlet of the Irish Sea. The county includes lovely Lake Windermere, the largest lake in England, and Ulswater, also a deep lake 7.5 miles long. Many of the villages and towns in the county are near the River Eden, which drains the Pennine chain of mountains and flows north into the Solway Firth, which is on the border between England and Scotland. In many respects, this lake country was idyllic. This is where William Wordsworth grew up, receiving his schooling, and wrote his lovely poems celebrating the beauties of nature. Also in the Lake District were the best liked of all the climbable peaks in Great Britain, with settings and scenic views eloquently described by Wordsworth. Beyond the lakelands and mountains was the Rocky South, with its old gray town of Kendal and its several fine castles and houses. Toward the east was Westmoreland's Vale of Eden, Valley of the River Eden, where there was grazing of sheep and cattle, quarrying of granite and slate, and the manufacture of woolens. Kendal had produced famous woolens since the 14th century. There were probably not more than a dozen families who lived in Pooley at the time of Agnes's birth, all of them owners of their homes and a few acres of land that had been purchased by their ancestors from the Earl of Sussex in 1680. Situated at the foot of the Cumbrian Hills and near the Ulswater, Pooley got its name from the nearby pool or lake. There was plenty of water and wood. The farmhouses and cottages were of gray stone, rough cast, and then whitewashed. There was good fishing in the lake and a small fish market. The Taylors remained in Pooley until Agnes was 2, at which time they moved to Brough, just a few miles southeast, and remained there 6 years. Bruff was a larger village with about 200 families. The outstanding architectural achievement was St. Michael's Church, named for the archangel in St. John's Revelation, who led the hosts of heaven in the battle against the forces of evil. As with other girls in the area, Agnes had a variety of inside and outside tasks. She took her turn gathering the dead sticks that blew down in the nearby forest. She lit the fire on occasion, took out the ashes, rubbed down the fender and tire irons, swept the floor, washed the hearthstone, set the table with cups and saucers, bowls and spoons, carried in the milk. After the meal, she washed the dishes, went on errands for her mother or father. She took walks with her mother and father or an older brother and sister in the countryside, strolling along the hedgerows and in the green fields, plucking the yellow buttercups and bright daisies and watching the wild flowers grow. She watched the ducks and geese with their bright white feathers swimming in the pond, the mother hen shepherding her little chicks about the yard, the sheep nibbling the tender grass, and the little lambs leaping about for joy, and the busy bees humming among the trees and bushes. The days in the English village, as she grew up, were not dull. There was a weekly market day, and she enjoyed the excitement and noises, if not the smells, at the market. There was the yearly May Day, when the girls dressed in white with appropriate trimmings and would sing and dance around the village maypole. Easter, when brightly colored eggs were rolled down the hillside to symbolize rolling the stone from Christ's tomb. In July, the children carried their bearing, wooden crosses decorated with flowers and rushes or baskets of flowers, as they walked through the village singing a special hymn. In November, on Guy Fawkes Day, a village bonfire was held and a carnival atmosphere prevailed. Other days of celebration were Halloween, Christmas, and New Year's. Agnes would also enjoy the village folklore, the stories that came down from the old Celtic tales. When Agnes was 9, her parents moved a little to the west, a few miles to the west, to a village called Shap. Here Agnes remained until she left home during her late teenage years to work in the Big House, a manorial home with a variety of servants. Anciently, Shap had been a large forest, and there was still forested land in the area when the Taylors lived there. About 180 families comprised that village. Here, also, the church was named for St. Michael. There were lots of St. Michael churches in England, still are. As Agnes moved into her teens, the various village celebrations became more meaningful. There was an annual well dressing when the villagers, grateful for their good water, decorated their well and offered a prayer of thanksgiving. The decorations often depicted a religious theme and were executed by pressing flowers and petals into clay. Sometimes on May Day, there was a Morris dance in which the villagers dressed in costumes often resembling characters in the Robin Hood legend and participated in a folk dance. The village was often visited by mummers, traveling actors or minstrels who wore masks or fantastic disguises. The villages held athletic contests, pancake races, rabbit pie scrambles, rugby and cricket matches, marble contests, and cheese rolling competitions. Often, on a date important to the village, such as the date of its founding, the construction of its cathedral, or the death of a prominent citizen, there might be a village celebration in which the mayor or other local leader, costumed in a huge garland of flowers, led a pilgrimage to the church, where there would be music an oration, the presentation of awards, and other festivities. Hot cross buns would be provided for everyone, a special treat to the poor who often could only afford black bread. Do we need it? Should I just put it out? Unfortunately, we have no direct evidence of the schooling received by Agnes, but with both of her parents educated, and the fact that she attracted a husband who is also well-educated, we assume that she attended the village grammar school and learned character-building poems and songs. Since the schools were close by, she walked from her home in the morning, walked home for a midday dinner, and back again in the afternoon. She learned when she was young to sew, spin, and weave. By the time she was 13, she had learned to draw out, twist, and wind the fibers. She darned and knitted socks and mittens, as well as cutting out and sewing clothes, learned embroidery, tatting, and needlepoint, doing buttonholes, and in other ways, helped to clothe the family. Her parents were active in the local Church of England. All of the children were duly christened shortly after birth. Their marriage was in the church. Members of the family were buried in the parish graveyard. The family was visited regularly by the Episcopal parish priest. Agnes went to Sunday school, participated in family Bible readings, was taught to pray. Some doctrines of the church did not appeal to her as a young person. One, that God was incomprehensible, incorporeal, and inscrutable. Another, that unbaptized infants were condemned to hell. Another, that men and women were creations of God but not children of God. And finally, that the human spirit or soul did not exist prior to conception or birth. And she did not believe in the natural or innate sinfulness of people, because of the so-called sin of Adam and Eve. She believed devoutly in the teachings of Jesus and was brought up to be a moral and happy person. She was impressed with the symbolism in the local parish church, often visited it, especially enjoyed the bell ringing that went on, sometimes in exultation, sometimes in grief, sometimes in patriotism, sometimes in religious fervor. When she reached the age of 16, she went to work as a domestic in the manor house of the region. There, she had the opportunity of helping with the housework, the meals, the sewing, the chores, going occasionally to the larger towns nearby, Kendall or Penrith, going to the fairs, dealing with local artisans, blacksmiths, cobblers, watchmakers, butchers, saddlers, and tailors. Of course, on these occasions, she might meet a local swain, and this is how she met James Taylor. When she was 18 and he 22, they were married. James and his parents lived on an estate known as Craig Gate in Ackenthwaite, Westmoreland. This is a short distance south and west of Kendall, the county seat. James's ancestors had lived there for several generations, but James was the third son of his father, and under the English laws of primogeniture, the estate went to the oldest son, so James and his other brothers and sisters had to fend for themselves. Nevertheless, James acquired a good English education, including some proficiency in Latin and Greek and the higher branches of mathematics. He started out as an apprentice to a carpenter, but eventually an uncle on his mother's side bequeathed to him a small estate in Hale, also in Westmoreland, and he ended up as a farmer. James took Agnes to Kirk Oswald, Oswald Church to Mary, some 25 miles down the Eden River. After the ceremony, which occurred in 1805, they drove back to Aconthwaite, the home of James, and James soon received a government appointment collecting customs duties. This caused him and Agnes to move from place to place. They were for a time at Milnthorpe, a small seaport near Aconthwaite and south of Kendal. About 1814, they moved to Liverpool, remained there 5 years. In 1819, they settled on James's recently inherited estate in Hale. From the time of their marriage in 1805 until their migration to Canada in 1830, Agnes and James had 10 children, 8 sons and 2 daughters. The oldest son, Edward, died in his early 20s. The other two other sons, William and George, died during their first year, and their last two sons, George and Edward, died as boys. There was a tendency to name later sons after earlier ones that had died. So Agnes and James ended up with a family of 5, 3 boys and 2 girls. This heavy mortality, 5 out of 10, was not unusual. All of the children were born in the area south of Kendal. Their most famous son, John Taylor, succeeded Brigham Young as president of the church, was born in 1808 in Stainton near Milnthorpe, the small seaport on the Bay of Morecambe. A historical marker was placed there in 1974. Because of the death of his older brother, John became, next to his father, the head of the family. Milnthorpe, where John was born, was named for the paper mill powered by the river Betha, coming from Betham, which ran by there and into the Irish Sea. With the only port facility in the county, Milnthorpe was also a market town with a market weekly on Friday. At Betham, to which the family moved when John was 10, there was a large structure called Betham Hall, and people used that as a community gathering place, and the Taylors joined other villagers in going there for entertainment and discussion and so on. Agnes was a good housekeeper, had a contagious sense of humor, maintained high standards for her husband and family. There was unity in the family, and family members enjoyed their life at home. In addition to household tasks, she and James sent their children to school, associated with the parish of the church, made sure the children were taught the catechism and prayers of the church, and in other ways sought to prepare their children for life. John, the future prophet, said that after their removal to Hale when he was 11, can we just turn this off? I think I can talk loud enough. Is this the way to do it? Okay. John says of his experience going to school when he was 11, I well remember some of my boyish pranks as I wended my way with satchel to school. I got mixed up with plowing, sowing, reaping, and haymaking, and have indelibly impressed on my mind some of my first mishaps in horsemanship in the shape of sundry curious evolutions between the horses' backs and terra firma. He was apprenticed to a cooper in Liverpool when he was 14. When his employer failed after a year, John returned to his home and remained with Agnes and James until they arranged for him to go to Penrith to learn the business of a turner, one who fashions or shapes wooden objects on a lathe. John was there 5 years, from the time he was 15 until he was 20. Something happened while John was in Penrith that would affect all the family for the rest of their lives. A year after he went there, that is when he was 16, he heard the Methodist doctrine taught and was converted. It seemed to me more a matter of fact, a personal thing, than the Church of England, he wrote. He prayed frequently, studied the Bible, read works on Christian theology. The next year, while he was still apprenticed as a turner, he became a Methodist exhorter, or local preacher. His first appointment was at a small village 7 miles from Penrith, Temple Sowerby. A brother from the Penrith church accompanied John as he walked to the village the first time. After they'd gone about a mile, John later wrote, "A peculiar influence overpowered me. I stood still and remarked to the brother who was with me, 'I have a strong impression on my mind that I have to go to America to preach the gospel.' At that time," he says, "I knew nothing about America except what I had learned in geography class in school. But I could not shake it off, this impression. I had some work to do which I did not then understand." He told Agnes and James about this experience. They accepted it as a legitimate whispering of the Spirit. When John was 20 and had mastered the art of turner, he returned to their home in Hale, conducted business for himself under the auspices of his father. Then, shortly thereafter, in 1830, because of John's wish to go to America, Agnes, now 43, and James, 47, and family, emigrated to Upper Canada, that's present-day Ontario. They left John behind to dispose of some unsold property and to settle affairs of the estate. In 2 years, John followed his parents to Canada, and the family was once more united, this time in the New World. They settled on a farm near York, the capital of Upper Canada. York was later incorporated as Toronto. During the years after 1815, several thousand English, Scottish, and Irish settlers had gone there, as had the Taylors, and formed the basis for the strong British-oriented culture of that region in the early years of the 19th century. Once more, however, the welfare of Agnes and James and their family would be affected by an action of their son. John, who established a turner shop adjoining his home near York, had continued to preach Methodism in Canada, but according to his own personal history, became increasingly dissatisfied with the doctrines of the church. "I often wondered," he wrote, "why the Christian religion was so changed from its primitive simplicity, and became convinced, before I dare acknowledge it, that we ought to have apostles, prophets, pastors, teachers, and evangelists, inspired men as in former days." Still ringing, isn't it?
I think I'll just try to put it off. Does it go? It doesn't go now, does it? Does it? Where do you turn it off? Okay. Well, I used to have my, what I said to my children, accompanied by squeals. This is the first time I had that done in Sunstone Symposium. When John, John found other persons who entertained similar views, mostly local preachers of the same church, and they met together several times a week to study the scriptures and pray. He continued to preach, but to use his words, he was more interested in teaching the leading doctrines of the Christian religion rather than the peculiar dogmas of Methodism. He married Leonora Cannon an immigrant from the Isle of Man and Liverpool in 1833. One day in 1836, Elder Parley P. Pratt, one of the finest of the early Latter-day Saint evangelists, arrived in Toronto, as York was now called, and was introduced to John. John's response, as given in his 1838 history, was as follows. I wrote down 8 of the first sermons that he preached and compared them with the scriptures. I also investigated the evidence concerning the Book of Mormon and read the Doctrine and Covenants. I made a regular business of it for 3 weeks and followed Brother Parley from place to place. At length, being perfectly satisfied of the truth of Mormonism, I was baptized by him. My wife was also baptized at the same time. I have never doubted any principle of Mormonism since. John was soon ordained an elder, preached the glad tidings of the Restoration to his parents, and Agnes and James also became members. They were baptized by John in May 1836, when Agnes was 48. Their enthusiastic reception of the gospel paved the way for the conversion of their daughters, Elizabeth and Agnes, and of their youngest living son, William. John remained as presiding high priest in Canada during the next 2 years. When John and Leonora moved to Missouri in late 1838, Agnes and James moved as well. As they reached the border of Missouri, however, they were turned back by the mob, who were in the process of driving the saints from the state. They spent the winter of 1838-39 in a temporary refuge in Quincy, Illinois, then in Warsaw, Illinois. John, who was called by revelation to be one of the Council of 12 Apostles in July 1838, and Leonora, they established their home in Nauvoo, actually just across the river at Montrose, Iowa. But Agnes and James soon moved on to a wilderness location 30 miles to the north of Nauvoo, to a place called Oquaka, the county seat of Henderson County. Oquaka was on the Mississippi River on the western edge of Illinois. They remained at this location until the winter of 1845-46, when the Taylors joined the Nauvoo Saints in preparation for the migration west. John was in the British Isles for almost 2 years on a mission, but upon his return, Agnes occasionally visited him in Nauvoo. And Agnes attended some parties and entertainments and dinners, as well as just visiting with her son. One episode at Oquaka has special interest. In 1842, an attempt was made on the life of Governor Lilburn Boggs of Missouri. Enemies of the church in Missouri determined to extradite Joseph Smith to the state to stand trial for that and other crimes and delinquencies. Certain that he would not receive a fair trial in Missouri, which had earlier expelled the saints, the prophet sought to avoid arrest. He had also received word that some persons were determined to return him to Missouri, dead or alive. And in September 1842, his home was searched. Nevertheless, he managed to elude the kidnapping party, which had come without legal documents permitting an arrest. He decided to go to the home of James and Agnes Taylor in this wilderness location in Oquaka and stay there several weeks out of circulation. He stayed there at first 2 weeks, went back to Nauvoo during a night time, stayed that night and went back to Oquaka, stayed there another period. He enjoyed Agnes's potato pie and roast lamb smothered with her special Cumbrian sauce. Agnes often expressed her pleasure at this visit, almost a month long, of the prophet. She highly appreciated the confidence, as one of her friends said, the confidence which he reposed in the integrity of her partner and herself in selecting their residence as a place of retreat at a time when he was menaced by great danger. His friendship and the teachings which she received from him during those days were among the most pleasing recollections of her subsequent life. When it became clear that the saints would have to leave Illinois, as they had left Missouri, in the winter of 1845-46, Agnes and James moved to Nauvoo, prepared for the journey west, drove across Iowa in early 1846, stayed at winter quarters, Nebraska, until the spring of 1847, and then, in company with her husband and four of their children, made the trek west to the Great Basin. They left winter quarters when Agnes was 59 and James 63. They traveled in the fourth 10 of the first 50 under the leadership of their son, William Taylor, now 23 years old. Present also on the trip were their daughters, Elizabeth and Agnes, with her three children, their daughter-in-law, Lovina, wife of William, and of course, John and Leonora. 1 month out on the trip, in North Platte, Nebraska, Elizabeth was married to George Boys in a ceremony performed by John. They arrived in the Salt Lake Valley in September 1847, lived in a section of the old fort which had been finished by the advanced group of pioneers, remained there until 1849, then with the assistance of John, they moved into a log cabin in the Salt Lake 14th Ward, west of Main Street and south of North Temple Street. Their son John was in the same ward, as were Apostle Parley Pratt, who had converted John, and Apostle Wilford Woodruff, always a good friend. John Murdoch, a close friend of the Prophet Joseph Smith, was the first bishop. Agnes finally died in November 1868, age 81. She left five children, John, Elizabeth, Agnes, and William in Utah, and son James in Canada. Husband James, to whom Agnes had been married almost 63 years, died 2 years later in 1870, age 87. One of those who knew Agnes best was George Q. Cannon, an apostle at the time of her death and brother of Leonora Cannon Taylor, the wife John had married in Canada. George, having had much in common with Agnes and James, wrote an obituary and editorial about her in the Deseret News upon her death. Agnes was always of a buoyant, hopeful, and cheerful turn of mind and deeply religious. She took great delight in her religion, and until last fall, when she was prostrated by a severe sickness, her presence was rarely missed at meetings, no matter how stormy the weather might be. Until she had that sickness, she was remarkable for her sprightliness, energy, and strict attention to business, and the weight of years sat as lightly upon her as upon many who are not half her age. During her sickness, she maintained her cheerfulness and equanimity. Death had no terrors for her, and his approach could not disturb her happiness. She knew in whom she trusted. He had never forsaken her, and in her last hours, he sustained and comforted her. She fell asleep calmly and without a struggle. Her face in death wore a peaceful and happy smile. Her son, John, was one of the most accomplished polemical writers in our history, one of the finest editors, and one of our finest doctrinal writers, a writer who brought pleasure to his mother during the time that she was still alive, and who brought honor to her after her death. Thank you.
There's no one I'd rather share the podium with than my father. I've introduced him on many occasions, times like these and in lectures and that sort of thing. But as the moderator has mentioned, it's the first time that he and I have been able to present material that we've worked on in a professional way together. And that's a real treat for me. It seems like I continue each day to learn a lot from him, learning a lot about history, learning a lot that will help me as a writer and a research as well as a human being. And besides that, I have him to thank for my sizable nose and my towering stature. I'm going to steal just a couple of minutes before I read my paper on Jeanette McKay to make just some general observations, if I can, that were interesting to me that maybe I could pass on to you as I became better acquainted with these 13 women who have influenced so many lives. The first thing that became very clear to me and my father was really what, with few exceptions, what an obscure group of women they are. In fact, I've asked several groups that I've spoken to even see how many that they could name. And for some reason, the first response is always Emma Smith, as being one of the mothers of prophets that they knew. So I could see from that that we had a work cut out for us to change the what people knew about the mothers of the prophets. We found in our research a really delightful story that I think illustrates that not only do we not know much about these women, but sometimes even their own children fail to give them some of the credit that was due to them. And the example that was that showed this a little bit is a story that involved Joseph Fielding Smith. And evidently, after he was a grown man, he was home on some kind of a visit and the family was together. And he began to brag a little bit about all the things he used to do when he was a young boy. And he talked about planting the garden and tending his brothers and sisters. And he milked the cow and he did this and that. And I guess his mother got a little tired of this. And she says, "Well, Joseph Fielding, what do you think I was doing all this time?" And you have to know that she raised 11 children. And he was quite taken back by that. And he said, "Well, I guess you just puttered around." Let me throw out just a few little bits of trivia, maybe to add a few more Mormon trivia questions to the already large assortment floating around. For example, they have a diverse background. Idaho. Two mothers of prophets never joined the church, for the obvious reason, of course, that they died before the church was organized. And those two mothers were Abigail Young and Beulah Woodruff. It was interesting to me, as I set up a little graph at home, and I saw how many, first of all, how many children were in the families that these mothers came from. In other words, how many children they were one of in that family, and also compared it to how many children they themselves had. And for some reason, the number 11 kept popping up. For instance, six of these mothers came from children of from exactly 11 children, and five of them themselves had 11 children. And this was a mystery to me until one day it became very clear. There's really a obvious reason for this. Those of you who have done genealogical research and filled out family group sheets, if you look at it, there are exactly 11 spaces on the family group sheet. So that seemed to be the thing to do.
Remember, your dad came from 11.
There we go. It's a common number, and I don't know how to explain that. In contrast to this, there was one prophet who was his mother's only child. And I'll say his mother's because his father had other children. But that, of course, was Heber J. Grant. Concerning polygamy, two of these women grew up in polygamist families, and four of them were polygamist wives themselves. The ones who maybe died at the youngest age, Beulah Woodruff died at the very young age of 26, and Olive Kimball died at the age of 46. Those that lived the longest, Rachel Ivins Grant, who died at the age of 88, and Julina Lamson Smith, who died at the age of 86. Four of these women lived to see their sons become apostles: Rachel Grant, Julina Smith, Louisa Bingham Lee, and Agnes Taylor. And I don't know if you've stopped to think about it, but there was only one of those 13 women who lived to see their son become prophet, and that was, of course, Lucy Mack Smith. As I present this material on Jeanette McKay, I'd like to make maybe one helpful clarification at the first. There are several references to David McKay, and I will refer to the father, David McKay, as such, and the future prophet as David O. On a lovely April evening in 1883, David and Jeanette McKay gathered their four children around the fireplace of their rock home in Huntsville, Utah. David had just returned from serving a two-year mission for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in the Highlands of Scotland. And David O., age 9, Thomas, 7, and Jeanette, 4, were eager to hear their father's adventures in that far-off land. Two-year-old Annie sat on her father's knee and spent the evening getting acquainted with this gentle, bearded man who left for Scotland just 10 days before she was born. As David told the children about Scotland, describing the fields of heather, the music of bagpipes, the castles, and the thousands of sheep dotting the hillsides, one of his young sons asked him if he had seen any miracles while he was on his mission. David's eyes immediately met those of his wife, Jeanette, and he made a comment that I might add the children that were sitting in front of him that evening remembered for the rest of their lives. And he made the comment, "Your mother is the greatest miracle that I have ever seen on this earth." Such fulsome praise was frequently expressed by David McKay and his children for their beautiful, dark-eyed Welsh mother and wife and mother, Jeanette Evelyn Evans McKay. As David toured the farm and home upon his return, he had good reason to believe that his wife was able to work miracles. David's mission call had come in 1881 at a most inconvenient time for the little family. Jeanette was expecting their sixth child right away, and her husband was reluctant to leave her home alone with the responsibility of the children and the crops. They had just made their last payment on the farm, and their dream of enlarging their home now seemed within reach. Emotionally, David and Jeanette McKay were still feeling the pains of grief from the loss just 1 year earlier of their two oldest children. Margaret, age 11, had died of rheumatic fever, and Elena, age 8, died just a few days later of pneumonia. The two girls were buried in the same grave. But when David's mission call arrived, young David O. observed what was the first and only open disagreement he ever saw his parents have. His father's reaction was, "Of course, I cannot go," to which his wife Jeanette quickly replied, "Of course, you will go. David O. and I will manage things quite nicely." And manage they did. With the considerable help and support of friends and neighbors, Jeanette quickly set about supervising David O. and his younger brother Thomas in learning more about running the farm and helping with household chores. Priesthood Quorums did their spring planting for them, and by summer an excellent crop of hay and grain was ready for harvest. But grain prices were low, so Jeanette decided to store her grain until spring. Prices were good then, so she sold and realized a very healthy profit. Encouraged, she and her sons worked even harder the next season and were secretly able to afford the addition to her house that Jeanette and David had planned before he left. What she did was she swore everyone to secrecy, the priesthood Carms and her children, and she wanted to remodel the home without her husband knowing about it while he was away. So, with that plan, several bedrooms were added, the dining room and kitchen were expanded. Jeanette was particularly proud of a new wide stairway leading up to the boys' bedrooms. Many a winter night, she had dressed herself warmly, gone outside, climbed up a ladder, climbed in a window in order to have evening prayers with her sons and tuck them in bed. Jeanette's willingness to sacrifice by having her husband gone for this length of time surely reflected her own personal gratitude for the two humble missionaries who knocked on the door of her parents' home in 1850 in southern Wales and changed their lives so enormously. Jeanette Evelyn Evans was born August 28, 1850, the seventh of the 11 children, there's that 11 again, of Margaret Powell and Thomas Evans. Margaret and Thomas had married in 1837 and had made their home in a tiny cottage in Cefn Coed, Glamorganshire, Wales. Illustrative of their Welsh upbringing, it is said that before Thomas proposed to Margaret, in accordance with custom, he carved for her a wooden spoon that he presented to her as a token of his love. The intricate design on the spoon revealed just how much he cared. During the carving, he was said to be spooning, a folk expression that came to be synonymous with courtship among Welsh peoples in the 18th and early 19th centuries. In prehistoric times, the British Isles were inhabited by the Cymric and Brythonic branch of the Celts. These accomplished people, successfully pushed back by waves of Anglo-Saxons, Romans, Scandinavians, and Normans, ultimately remained the principal occupants of the western peninsula known as Cambria or Wales, an upland region dominated by the Cambrian Mountains, the highest and wildest in Britain. There are numerous small streams and lakes, and the countryside is scenic with almost a theatrical grandeur. South Wales ultimately became a coal and iron mining center. It was at Merthyr Tydfil, named for the 5th century Princess Martyr, near Cefn Coed, that Richard Trevithick's steam locomotive was first tried on rails in 1804 and successfully hauled a trail of 10 tons of iron and 70 men on a tramway when Jeanette Evans was 4 years old. Although conquered by the English in the 13th century, the Welsh retained much of their native language and culture, and Jeanette's family spoke Welsh in their home when she was growing up. I might add that I spoke in an interview with her grandson, David Lawrence McKay. He said that frequently, even after she was grown and married, that she would get together with her brother, and he remembers hearing them talking in this Welsh dialect. So she remembered it and kept it throughout her life. Because Merthyr Tydfil is in the very heart of the coal mining region of Wales, its lovely broad low mountains and deep lush valleys were somewhat tempered in beauty by what Thomas Rees described in 1815 in The Beauties of England and Wales as the perpetual smoke and constant din of the forges. At night, when the furnaces were opened, one visitor observed, the sky looked as if a blazing volcano were erupting. Yet the misty bogs and grassy slopes surrounding these pit towns are among the most scenic in Wales. Coal mining and metal processing had been the country's chief industry since the Industrial Revolution began in Great Britain in the 1700s, and it was in these mines that Jeanette's father, Thomas, earned the family's income as an ironstone miner. The house in which Jeanette and her 10 siblings were born is one of the many thousands of what they call row houses, or long rows of houses connected on to each other, which snake through the villages and across the countrysides. The house is certainly a humble one by today's standards, but in those days, even the poorest houses were often comfortably furnished with a good sofa, table, mahogany chest of drawers, knickknacks, porcelain figures, 8-day clocks, and painted jugs hanging from the rafters. Religious prints or photographs of Queen Victoria and Prince Albert were usually on the walls. Jeanette surely accompanied her mother many times to the Wednesday and Saturday markets, where over 100 stalls were occupied by traders selling everything from butter and cheese, bacon, to drapery, shoes, and books. Children of the village of Cefn Coed contributed to the market in their own small way by collecting bundles of bulrushes on the Kilsanus Mountain, which was later used as wicks for the candles. Jeanette had pleasant memories of South Wales. Among other things, she told her children that there was a stone shaped like a chair just a little way up the stream from their cottage. She would walk up the stream and take off her shoes and let her feet hang down in the water. While Thomas spent long hours amid the hot furnaces of the ironworks, Margaret did her best to provide pleasant and healthy living conditions for her children. F. Vaughan writes in The Women of Merthyr in the 19th Century, women took great pride in trying to keep their homes spotless, fighting a hard battle against the squalor outside. Indeed, the 1849 public health records of Merthyr paint a grim picture of the sanitary conditions that the Evans family contended with. The rapidly growing industrial region had no sewer system, poor drainage, and there was little or no access to fresh water, all of which dramatically increased the incidence of sickness and death. Major epidemics of scarlet fever, typhoid, measles, and whooping cough raged through Merthyr, and the greatest toll was among the young. In 1854, the public health record reads, "More than half of the funerals which took place are of children less than 5 years of age, and more than one-fourth are infants under 1 year." The biggest killer was cholera, which claimed 824 lives in 1854 alone. The Evans family buried three children that same year, two-year-old daughter and infant twins, a daughter and a son. 2 years after this terrible experience, Margaret and Thomas Evans decided they had more than one reason to pack up their belongings and seek a better life for their children. A few months before Jeanette was born, her parents had heard the restored gospel, received a testimony of its truthfulness, and had been baptized in May of 1850. A determined and active member, Thomas served as the president of the Merthyr Tydfil Conference of the Church. Family members later felt it was more than just a coincidence that William and Ellen Oman McKay, parents of Jeanette's future husband, were baptized members of the church the very same year in Scotland. The Evans of Wales and the McKays of Scotland were among 4,300 European saints who sold their property and immigrated to America in 1856. Jeanette's mother, Margaret, paid one last visit to the graves of five of her children and then journeyed to Liverpool, England, where she and her husband boarded the ship Horizon with their six remaining children. Anne, age 16, Thomas, 14, Evan, 12, Howell, 10, Jeanette, 6, and a new baby, Elizabeth. The Evans family set sail May of 1856 and were among 856 saints under the leadership of Edward Martin. All were eager to join the saints in Utah. Ironically, about 600 of this group became members of the second handcart company to be caught in a terrible early storm on the prairie in 1856, and some 145 of them perished. The Evans family, however, had decided not to travel all the way to Utah that year and instead remained in Iowa for 3 years while Thomas accumulated provisions, equipment, and clothing. The McKay family also waited. In 1859, Thomas and Margaret had obtained wagons, teams, and a milk cow and joined Philip Buzzard's Utah-bound company. They arrived in Salt Lake City August 24th, 4 days ahead of young Jeanette's future in-laws, the McKays. 2 weeks later, they moved to Ogden. In spite of their surprisingly parallel travels, the Evans and McKay families never met until, shortly after the Evans' arrival in Ogden, 15-year-old David McKay saw the attractive 9-year-old Jeanette sitting on the tongue of the family wagon. He later said he could not forget those big brown eyes under her pink sunbonnet. As Jeanette grew, she became one of the most attractive and popular young women in Ogden, and David's interest in her only increased. Jeanette lived with her family in a temporary log cabin before they moved to a comfortable four-room rock home, considered rather elaborate for this time. Jeanette helped considerably with the upkeep of the house and garden. Jeanette made friends easily, and many of her social experiences were combined with activities providing the necessities of life. Often she and her friends would sit together to make a quilt or rug, knit stockings, or peel peaches for drying. Dances were nearly always held on Fridays and special holidays, and these occasions were a perfect opportunity for numerous young men to court Jeanette. Jeanette also attended school. The early Latter-day Saint settlers in Ogden considered the proper education of their children second in importance only to the worshiping of God. Schools were erected almost as quickly as their homes. The first school in Ogden was established as early as 1849, just 2 years after the first company of pioneers arrived in Salt Lake Valley. Thus, little Jeanette, 9 years old, went to school in the Second Ward School in Ogden. There, she studied under two sisters, Harriet Canfield Brown and Rose Canfield, who were among the finest teachers in Pioneer, Utah. Harriet and Rose were both from New York State and graduated from an Eastern Academy and taught school there. Harriet then moved to Council Bluffs, Iowa, where she met Latter-day Saints for the first time and was baptized in 1854. She went to Utah in 1856, settled in Ogden in time to start the Second Ward School under Bishop Edward Bunker. She also taught in the Sunday School. Rose Canfield, her younger sister, arrived in Ogden later, settled near her sister and brother-in-law, and assisted Harriet as teacher in the Second Ward School. Teachers in Ogden for more than 30 years, the Canfield sisters implanted a love for books and good education among the Evans children and hundreds of other pioneer young people. Through Jeanette Evans, who later married David McKay and became the mother of the prophet David O., and his brothers and sisters, the Canfields had a lasting influence on the region and the church. It was with the encouragement of the Canfield sisters that Jeanette started a lending library for her friends and family members. Jeanette herself joined them as a fellow teacher for a short period of time and was so employed when she was proposed to by the attentive and hard-working lad from Scotland, David McKay. By the time he proposed, David had been courting Jeanette for many months and finally had earned enough money to pay for a small farm in Huntsville in Ogden Valley, east of Ogden. He persuaded Jeanette's parents to let him marry their daughter, even though she was not yet 17 years old. Their marriage was performed by Apostle Wilford Woodruff, April 9, 1867, in the Endowment House in Salt Lake City. They settled in a log cabin David had built in Huntsville. Jeanette was considered one of the prettiest girls in the region, and David wanted her to stay that way. So he refused to let her work in the fields and insisted, when they could later afford it, on obtaining help for her in the house. He admired her beautiful hands and lovely clear complexion. It is not accidental that the McKay boys acquired the reputation of being handsome and the McKay girls strikingly beautiful. As a new bride, Jeanette had to adjust to many things, including frequent visits of Indians to their new farm. President Brigham Young had counseled them to feed them rather than fight them, and Jeanette tried her best to be friendly and generous, but she was always somewhat nervous. On one occasion, a young Indian brave decided Jeanette would make a lovely bride for him. He came into the McKay cabin one morning while she was washing clothes and startled her with the announcement, "You be my squaw." She grabbed a wet towel from the washtub, struck the surprised Indian in the face, and ran to the room where her husband was sleeping. As soon as the Indian realized that Jeanette was not alone, he hurried to his horse and disappeared. Two daughters, Margaret and Elena, were born to Jeanette and David before the front part of the Rock House, now known affectionately by the McKay family as the Old Home, was completed. It was a happy day for the little family when they moved from the log cabin into this larger and much more comfortable home, and it was there that President David Oman McKay was born September 8, 1873. Seven more children followed: Thomas Evans, Jeanette Isabel, Ann Powell, Elizabeth Odette, William Monroe, Catherine Favorite, and Morgan Powell. Motherhood seemed to be a role that fit Jeanette perfectly. Together with her husband, she created an atmosphere in her home of tenderness, patience, and love. Daily prayer was held with the children, and gospel principles were taught daily by word and example. Surely the many hundreds of sermons that President McKay would later give in his life can be traced to his own childhood experiences in the Old Home, which he often referred to as the dearest, sweetest spot on earth. President McKay once described a nostalgic visit to the family home in 1938 in a letter to his brother Thomas E., who was then serving as president of the Swiss-German mission. He closed with these tender lines: "It is only an old country home, but no palace was ever filled with truer love and devotion on the part of the parents, brothers, and sisters than those which pervaded the hearts of the loved ones in that family circle. When I walked out the front door, as the night latch clicked, I thought it might have been the click of the lid of a treasure chest which held the wealth of memories that no money could buy." Jeanette and Thomas made great financial sacrifices to ensure a good education for each of these children. They maintained a separate home in Ogden on Madison Avenue, for example, where they lived during the winter so their children could attend school there. Then they returned to the farm for the summer months. With financial assistance from Grandmother Evans and by mortgaging their farm, they were able to afford to do something that was remarkable then and is remarkable today, and that is that they sent each of their eight surviving children to the university, and all eight graduated with college degrees. Seven of the children filled honorable missions for the church, and Thomas E. served two missions, with David O. completing three. Jeanette was involved with Relief Society, the Young Ladies Mutual Improvement Association in their Huntsville ward, but most of her energy was spent raising her family and supporting her husband as he served as bishop of the Eden and Huntsville wards, as patriarch, and later as a member of the High Council of the Weber Stake of Zion. Her husband also served in the Utah Territorial Legislature, being elected a state senator for 3 4-year terms. Church leaders visiting the Huntsville area frequently stayed at the McKay home since the town had no restaurant or hotel. The table in their large dining room was always kept out full length, and guest rooms were nearly always occupied, especially on weekends. The McKay children, therefore, met and ate dinner with members of the First Presidency of the Church, many general authorities, and officers of church auxiliaries. At many times when there were guests for dinner, Jeanette had a special code, FHB, which stood for Family Hold Back. The children were encouraged to hold back from taking too much food to be sure that everyone at the table got enough. The weight of her responsibilities eventually took a toll on Jeanette's health, and she experienced problems at a relatively young age. Jeanette Evelyn Evans McKay died at her home at the age of 54 on January 6, 1905, and was buried by a grieving family in Huntsville. It would be difficult to find a woman who has been remembered as fondly and as affectionately by her posterity as Jeanette McKay. President McKay spoke of her numerous times in sermons he gave during the many years he served as apostle and later as president of the church. On one occasion, President McKay wrote this about his mother: "I cannot think of a womanly virtue my mother did not possess. To her children and all those who knew her, she was beautiful and dignified. Though high-spirited, she was even-tempered and self-possessed. Her dark eyes immediately expressed any rising emotion, which, however, she always held in perfect control. In the management of her household, she was frugal, yet surprisingly generous in providing for the welfare and education of her children. In tenderness, watchful care, loving patience, loyalty to home and to right, she seemed to me in boyhood, and she seems to me now, after all these years, to have been supreme. During the intervening years since her death, I have often wished that I had told her in my young manhood that my love for her and the realization of her love and of her confidence gave me power more than once during fiery youth to keep my name untarnished and my soul from clay." President McKay and other members of the McKay family visited Wales on several occasions to see the village and home where their mother and grandmother were born. President McKay was in London in 1858 to dedicate the London Temple, and he expressed spontaneously a desire to visit Wales, and he and his sister, Jeanette McKay Morell, and her daughter, also named Jeanette, were driven to the area by former mission president A. Hammer Reiser. President Reiser wrote the following account of part of their trip in this diary, which I find quite touching. "Upon our arrival at Merthyr Tydfil, we began making inquiry for the location of the home. An older man keeping a petrol station up Kevin Road said, 'The house you're looking for is on the southwest hillside, there, near that new housing estate.' So we went to explore, up a steep, narrow, rough, rutted hillside road. I drove in the direction of the older homes on the hillside. We came out by a group of homes clinging to the road. There, a second road led to a row of 4 or 5 terraced houses, each with its front yard enclosed by fence and gate. The president said, 'Let's inquire here.' We were at number 69. Inside the fence came an old lady who looked friendly at me, and I asked for directions. By this time, President McKay had come into the yard. She turned to him and said, 'Oh, I know you.' It was Ann Morgan, a spinster who had been born in that house 76 years earlier. She assured President McKay that this is the place. Then she showed President McKay and his sister, Mrs. Morell, into the small 6x9 bedroom in which their mother was born, in which the bed completely occupied the narrow end of the room. President McKay and his sister stood with arms around each other, weeping their emotions at being in this beloved place. 3 years after this visit, President McKay returned to Wales in March of 1961 to break ground for a new LDS chapel in Merthyr Tydfil and to unveil a commemorative plaque, which he was given permission to have placed at his mother's birthplace. The loving relationship between Jeanette and her sons and daughters and her jovial nature is illustrated in an anecdote which President McKay told in a talk he gave in Merthyr Tydfil just prior to his dedicatory prayer for the new chapel. "I went home one weekend when I was in college," he said. "Mother was sitting on my left, where she always sat at dinner, and I said, 'Mother, I have found that I am the only one of your children that you have switched,'" meaning whipped with a willow shoot. "She said, 'Yes, David O. McKay,' or 'Yes, David O., I made such a failure of you, I didn't want to use the same method on the other children.'" This certainly put the future prophet in his place. When Jeanette died in 1905, the Salt Lake Tribune said of her, "Few women in Weber County were more widely known or more universally loved than Mrs. David McKay, and the announcement of her death has caused a gloom of sorrow, not only through Ogden City and Weber County, but over the entire state." Perhaps in conclusion, let me add something personal. I often, when I complete a project like this, a lot of people come up to you and say, "Well, what have you really learned? I mean, we know the facts and figures, but what have you really learned from this experience of becoming acquainted with these women?" And I suppose if it has had an influence on me philosophically in any way, I think it's changed my opinion of what true greatness is. The world looks for greatness in power, in money, in physical attractiveness, in how many people you know and how well known you are. But I found greatness in the lives of these lesser known women who are relatively obscure, who are lesser known, and who in a more quiet and obscure way made the world a more pleasant place to be. Thank you.
We'd like to thank our two speakers for their outstanding talks. We have a few minutes remaining for any questions you'd like to ask. You want to both try that?
There is, of course, the family history which Lucy Mack Smith wrote, which tells a lot about the early history of that family, and that was a rich source on her history. There is a biography of Mary Fielding Smith, the mother of Joseph F. Smith, which is well done and which offers a considerable amount of what we needed. Most of the others, we didn't have such a convenient source. There, some of the women, some of the mothers, there's absolutely no line that any of them ever wrote, and no letters, no personal histories, not even family histories written by their sons or grandsons. So we had to go the next step. We had to go to where they were born and grew up, and find local records that told something about the family, the ancestors of the family, the customs of the places they grew up, and so on. That was true of Agnes Taylor. I think in the Taylor family, we probably haven't found more than three lines about Agnes Taylor. But I had the opportunity of going to the British Museum in England and also to Westmoreland County. And so I was able to get a great deal of information by using contemporary sources, histories that were written, travelogues and so on, that were written about the time that Agnes was growing up. While you don't have a line from them that you can quote, you can always find a great deal that went on during the period they were growing up, and you know very well the things that they participated in and did. In the case of those who are more recent, we've had some interviews with Ezra Taft Benson's brothers and sisters about their mother. We've had interviews with some members of the Kimball family about the mother of Spencer Kimball. We've talked with grandchildren in the case of Sarah Farr Smith, and in the case of Heber J. Grant, and David O. McKay, so that we've had some family information, interviews, and so on through that source. The most difficult single problem that we had was with the mother of Wilford Woodruff, who died when he was only 19 months old, and so he didn't have any memory of her. And although he kept a very full journal and wrote lots of personal histories and family histories, he couldn't say much about her. But we were able to get a great deal of information about the place that she grew up in, which is the town of Avon near Farmington, Connecticut. And we managed to trace her family back to the very settlement of Farmington in 1640. So there's a lot of the family heritage that came to us. Wilford's father, Affick Woodruff, married again after his first wife died, probably to a cousin. So Wilford did know her, was raised by her, and so we have an essay that covers both his mother and his stepmother. Wilford Woodruff's family was interesting to trace because his father's name was Affick, his grandfather's name was Eldad, his oldest brother's name was Osman, and his next oldest brother's name was Ozum, and his stepmother's name was Azuba. All of these from 2 Kings. I think he has the record for the most interesting names in the family.
In connection with this, just a little, I want to share one little story to tell you how I got so much of my information about Merthyr Tydfil for this particular paper you've heard. One thing that the Arrington house was famous for when I was growing up was books. We had books everywhere, in every nook and cranny. And my friends had come over, and I thought every house was like this, but my friends had come and say, "What are you doing with all these books? Well, I've never seen so many books anywhere except for the Logan Library." And it was sort of a kind of a joke, because when we'd travel and get to a new place, Dad would always scurry into a used bookstore, and he'd come out with, like, two boxes, and he'd put them in the trunk, and some of the family was, you know, wondering very much aloud, what are we going to do with all these? We'll never need them, and, you know, why spend this money? Well, I guess a little bit of this got in my blood, and in 1979, my husband was able to take a sabbatical. Our family together took a sabbatical from Utah State University to London. And before we came home, we rented a camper and we drove up through northern England and Wales and Scotland. And we went, when we were in Wales, and I can't explain really why, but we found a little, I'm not sure now whether it was a library or a little bookstore of some kind. We went in there, and it was the only place the whole trip that we even did this. We went in and we picked up about 3 or 4 books on local history of Merthyr Tydfil. And even at the time I was buying them, I thought, when on earth, when we get back to Utah, am I ever going to open up these books? Well, as I started working on this and saw, you know, that where she was from, something clicked, and I went out in the garage and I found a box that said England stuff. That's my great filing system. And I opened up this book, and lo and behold, here was these four books on not only Wales, but Merthyr Tydfil, this very area. And as I opened it up, I was just so excited. In fact, I think I called Dad fairly quickly because I found information about that town exactly when she was there, and she was only there 6 years because they immigrated when she was six. But I found information about the town, about the, you know, the things that I read about what the homes were like, about the marketplace and the sanitary conditions, the public health material. So, you know, in all the acquiring of books, it certainly paid off that time. So.
Yes.
I think that's a really fair comment, that we need to keep that in mind when we write this. In fact, I saw a friend of mine last week downtown, and she asked me what I was working on. I told her that we had just finished this. And her first comment, and it came very quickly, was, "Were any of those women weak? Tell me they were weak." And, yes, some of them had problems in the families. George Albert Smith's mother, for instance, her youngest child was epileptic, and that was a real trial for Sarah Farr Smith to have an epileptic child who was having severe seizures and grabbing things that were hot and burning herself, and there was disagreements within the family of how to deal with that and what to do. I think it would be... Well, there was one mother that left the church, Wilfred Woodruff's stepmother, actually. She didn't really keep the strong testimony that maybe she had earlier. Also, Lorenzo Snow's parents did not go west with the church, and it had reasons to do particularly with the father being influenced by the anti-Mormon stories that were circulating at that time. It's hard to tell whether his wife, Rosetta, who was Lorenzo's mother, felt the same way or whether she was simply giving in and staying with her husband. But yes, they were all kinds. They had family problems, and these are things that sometimes maybe make us feel a little bit better in the long run. Do you want to add anything? I interviewed five grandchildren on the phone or in person, and they had nothing but good things to say. Sorry.
Well, I would certainly like to thank Leonard and Susan for their well-researched, delightful, and superbly crafted papers. I thoroughly enjoyed this session, and we thank you very much.